for you to do that, so I want you to wait for the days when I really need you. There are going to be days when maybe she's sick, or we have specialist appointments or CPS visits, or God, I don't even know, Sam. And I haven't really been planning my words as I spoke, but that sentence leads to a thought that just falls out of my mouth, and suddenly my eyes are full of tears. I don't know what's ahead of us, and I'm scared.
I'm scared too, he admits.
You are?
Of course I am.
A tear spills over onto my cheek and I press it away impatiently. Sorry, I whisper, and Sam shakes his head.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Don't apologize, Lexi. You're allowed to cry in front of me, for God's sake. I want you to.
I nod, and he pulls me close to rest his chin on the top of my head as we hear a hesitant knock at the door.
Sorry, Sam, Catherine calls. You're doing surgery in a few minutes?
Sam's arms remain locked around me.
Let them know I'm running late. I need 10 more minutes.
You can go, I whisper, and he shakes his head.
Nope, not until I finish this.
I'm okay, I promise. I start to pull away, but his arms don't budge.
I need this hug, Lexi.
At that, I nestle back into his embrace, and I close my eyes and listen to the steady beat of his heart against my ear. We stay like that for several minutes, until I gently pull away and brush a kiss against his lips.
Better?
He murmurs, and I smile. Much. Annie calls me later that evening.
You have phone privileges back?
I say in surprise when she identifies herself.
Time off solitary confinement for good behavior, she says wryly.
She sounds good, and I'm surprised by my own optimism as I realize this. It's been a good day after all.
So, things are going better?
I don't know, Annie says after a pause.
I no longer think about running away every time Luke speaks to me, so I'm going to take that as an improvement.
Whose idea was Dad's journal?
Mine.
Sometimes I think that maybe it's going to help.
So thanks,
she whispers, her voice suddenly uneven. She clears her throat, then says with artificial brightness,
Enough of this. Tell me about my girl. How is she doing?
She has also become a star patient since we last spoke. She's completely off the morphine.
Wow.
Annie's voice breaks and I hear her voice catch on a sob.
That's amazing.
Yep. She's coming home to my place tomorrow or the next day.
Oh, Lexi. Oh, thank you.
Annie is overcome as she laughs through tears.
This is the best news I could have hoped for. So she's well? She's... normal?
For the most part, she's doing brilliantly. There are a few areas we need to work on, but yes, Annie, she's an absolute fighter.
Does this mean you can bring her for a visit soon?
I hope so. I'll talk to her doctors. And yours, I think. But I don't tell her that Luke has specifically advised me against it.
I am so grateful to you, Lexi. I'm going to make all of this up to you, I swear.
Well, I say, and I'm surprised and pleased by this gratitude. I look forward to that. I forgot to buy a car seat. I got everything else a baby could possibly need, an expensive stroller, all the equipment for the nursery, formula we can actually use, diapers in multiple sizes that will probably not fit her until she's 2, clothes and a mobile and pacifiers and blankets. So when the doctor tells me that her discharge paperwork is done and a nurse asked me to bring the car seat in for a test run, I'm mortified to admit that I don't have one.
I want to cry as I drive myself all the way back to the baby store. It's not a big deal in the scheme of things, an inconvenience, but it's an ominous sign. If I can't remember something like a car seat, what else will I forget? Diaper changes, bottles, baths? I buy the highest safety-rated car seat, and I drive back to the NICU. I fuss over it in the parking lot, even though the guide at the store installed it, and it's no doubt set up perfectly. I adjust the straps and play with the seatbelt needlessly over and over again for 25 minutes until my phone rings. "Are you ever coming back?" the nurse asks, and there is laughter in her tone, as if this is a joke. I tighten a strap, and then I loosen it again. And then I realize that all this is for nothing because I have to take the car seat inside so the staff can monitor Daisy while she sits in it. I groan. "See you in 2 minutes." I head back into the hospital and gather up Daisy. As I lower her into the car seat, I'm almost hoping that she fails the test. It's all about respiration and body positioning. The car seat keeps the baby upright. And some babies who have been delivered early or have been ill struggle to breathe when lying in that position. Daisy will be monitored for 30 minutes. If at any point her oxygen levels drop, her discharge will be canceled, which would mean more days that she's safely in the hospital. The nurse leaves me with Daisy, and I stare at her. She is asleep, her translucent eyelids resting over her eyes, eyelashes hanging down low on her cheeks. I lift my hand, and I very gently touch her face. There is so much of Annie in this baby, so much of my father in her. The light hair, the shape of her eyes. I've seen Daisy mostly cry and sleep over these weeks, but she'll soon adapt to a more typical schedule and begin to hit normal newborn milestones. The rigidity in her muscles should fade, and she'll become floppy, the way newborns should be. Soon she will smile. Soon she will laugh. She is my responsibility. She is my problem. For the time being, she is also my privilege. I need to love Daisy, because somehow newborns know if they are loved. I've read studies of infants raised in orphanages and the difficulties they face with attachment later in life. Daisy literally needs me to love her. Daisy has had a very rough start to life, but she's not out of the woods yet. Somehow, we need to get Annie well quickly and in a position to provide Daisy with a stable upbringing. If we don't, there's every chance that I'll spend the next 20 years repeating what I've been doing for the last 20, caring for Daisy, caring for her mother. And if Daisy is damaged, she will damage others, just as Annie has. She will damage herself, just as Annie has. I haven't trained for this. Unlike clinical practice, there's no supervision of stand-in parents. I'm on my own. There's no textbook or reference charts for when I feel out of my depth. This is real life. This is an innocent, fragile, and somewhat blank canvas, and I need to start the painting of her life, then hand her over to her mother. It is all too much. And yet, once again, there is no one else but me. I take a deep breath, a sharp breath, and I add mentally with some force, "No one else but me and Sam." Quite suddenly, I find that I need him. There are still 10 minutes left on this car seat test, and now I'm shaking because I'm terrified. I dial Sam's cell, and the call is picked up on the second ring. But the voice that comes down the line doesn't belong to Sam. It's Catherine. "Hi, Lexi. Sam had to go back into surgery. Can I get a message to him?" I feel hot tears running over my cheek. I take a deep breath and ask only for him to call when he gets a chance. I set the cell down on the table beside the car seat, and I look at Daisy again. My head is full of information on how to care for a baby. I'm more than up to this challenge. Maybe if I tell myself that enough times,
I'll start to believe it.
32. Annie. Luke, let's talk about my sister, shall we? I can tell by the way that you keep asking that you're dying to dig into that fucked up mess of a relationship. I'd lived away from Lexi for almost 6 years by the time things started to fall apart for me. She'd finished med school and was halfway through a residency at a hospital in Montgomery. We were far too busy to visit each other often, so we generally saw each other only for Thanksgiving or Christmas, but we still spoke on the phone every week. In fact, we hadn't missed a Sunday night call in the entire time we'd been apart. But after I lost my job, my phone got cut off. I was in such bad shape by then, on the tail end of a week-long binge. I didn't even realize it was Sunday and that she'd be calling. Monday morning, Lexi rang my office looking for me. They told her that I had been fired, and she was on the next flight back to Chicago. I had no idea who was thumping on my door that day. I ignored it at first, assuming it was probably my landlord who was surely starting to wonder where my rent was. But the thumping continued, and then I heard someone yelling, so I eventually realized I had to answer it. I rolled over and sat up and saw my kit on the floor beside the mattress. I dropped a pillow onto it, pulled a sweater on, and stumbled to the peephole. My stomach dropped when I saw Lexi. She was wild-eyed and panicked, and I turned to look at my apartment. The living area was completely empty, just books and garbage, and a tattered rug left in the middle of the floor. Of course I was aware of the space emptying out as I sold my possessions, but it was only in that moment that I really realized how little was left. "Lexi, what are you doing here?" I asked, feigning delight to see her. I pulled her close for a hug and hoped I didn't smell too bad. When did I last shower? I had no idea. She stared at me, and I felt like a specimen in a laboratory right up until the moment she said, "What the hell is going on, Annie?" "What do you mean?" I asked her mildly, and then I followed her gaze to the empty apartment. "Oh, this? I'm moving."
"You're moving?"
Her incredulity was palpable, but I shrugged easily. "Yeah, I'm moving in with some friends. My furniture is already there."
"And your job? I called and they said you had been fired. I spoke to you last week and you didn't mention moving or being fired."
"I'm..." My mind was so foggy I couldn't keep up with having to produce convincing lies on the fly. "I have a new job."
"It's 3 o'clock. You're at home. And you've been asleep. What kind of job do you have that lets you sleep in until 3 o'clock?
"I work nights." Lexi wasn't buying it. She pulled away from me and started walking through the apartment, and I watched the slow dawn of horror on her face as she surveyed the garbage and the vast emptiness. She walked toward the bedroom, and I caught her arm as she approached the door. I glanced inside and saw the pillow had only half covered the kit. The tourniquet was in plain sight beside it.
"Lexi, no."
She shook me off and walked straight to the pillow. She pushed it out of the way with her foot, then raised her eyes and stared at me. "I know you counseling types like to talk about rock bottom, but I don't actually believe in it. Because if it was actually a thing, that moment with Lexi would have been it, and we wouldn't be in this situation 7 years later. That moment was worse than anything Robert had done to me, or even the ground falling out from under my world when I lost Dad." Lexi was staring at me with such terror and disgust that my skin was crawling with shame. I ran into the room, picked up the kit, and stuffed it back under the pillow as if that would somehow make her unsee it. Lexi walked right out of the room, and I stood alone for a moment, adrenaline pumping through me. I might have stayed there forever to avoid the looming confrontation, except that Lexi was now alone in my living area, and I couldn't remember where I'd hidden my stash. So I ran back out and found her standing in the middle of the empty space with her arms over her chest.
"You're going to rehab," she said flatly.
I opened my mouth to argue, but only the monster came out.
"Who do you think you are, you controlling bitch? You think you can come in here and fucking fix me? Really?"
I laughed at the shock on her face, and then I took a step toward her. Lexi stepped back, away from me, and I saw the fear in her eyes, and I fed off it. You think you're so fucking perfect, don't you? Clever little Lexi with her fucked up sister project. Well, Dr. Perfect, you can take your good intentions and your perfect life, and you can get the fuck out of mine. Annie, please. Lexi's eyes were swimming in tears, but through the veil of moisture, they pleaded with me. Fuck off, Lexi, you stupid meddling bitch. She'd backed all the way to the front door, and then I saw her turn and fumble for the handle. She was scared that I was going to hurt her, and she was right to be. As the door opened, I raised my hands and I pushed her. She stumbled into the hallway and landed against the wall, her face colliding hard as she fell to the floor. I didn't care. I didn't even check that she was okay. I slammed the door and then I turned what was left of my apartment upside down until I remembered that there was no stash left to find. I'd already used it. I needed a fix so bad that the inside of my brain felt like it was going to burn right through my skull. But there was only one thing left to hawk. I sold my computer that day. I didn't even think to make a backup of the manuscript I'd written, or any of the dozens of stories and essays I'd finished. I should have known it would take more than a physical assault to scare my sister away. She came right back the next morning. When I opened the door and saw her there, her face marked with ugly purple bruises, I burst into tears. I need help, I choked. I know, she whispered, and she rushed to embrace me. I know you do, love, but I'm here now, and we're going to sort this out, okay? It was months before Lexi told me Mom and Robert gave her the money for me to go to a private rehab clinic. Lexi hadn't spoken to them for almost 9 years, but when she found out how long the waitlist was for the public rehab centers, she felt she had no choice. I don't know if I would have gone if I'd known who was paying, but in the end, it didn't matter. I managed 4 days of the 30-day inpatient program. On the fifth day, I got into an argument with a counselor who wanted me to sing at a group therapy session. I refused, she tried to make me, and I inadvertently elbowed her in the face. They escorted me to the door 2 hours later. When Lexi picked me up, she asked me how I was feeling, and then she casually asked me if I wanted to move to Montgomery to live with her for a while. She didn't yell or cry or tell me she was disappointed. She simply offered an olive branch, and I grabbed at it with both hands. If anything was ever going to work, it might have been that approach. Lexi's no-strings-attached love has been one of the only good things that has persisted in my lifetime. She put up with 5 years of my addiction before it got to be too much, and she cut me off altogether. And even then, she reached that point only when I nearly got her fired. I lived with her for most of that time. I rarely paid rent, hardly contributed around the house, regularly stole from her, went on and off methadone and suboxone, got and lost countless jobs. I alienated her friends and scared away her boyfriends. I overdosed 3 times, twice in my bedroom, and for some reason I can't remember, once on the floor of her ensuite bathroom. Lexi found and revived me 3 times. She kept syringes of Narcan in her handbag, and in her car, and in her cosmetics bag. She found so many kinds of rehabs for me to try. I've done them all. I'd always go when and where she asked, but honestly, I've never understood why she bothered. How many thousands of dollars do you sink into a person before it stops being selfless and starts being ridiculous? How many times do you bother to revive someone who is nothing but a drain on you and society? Do you know what impact I've had on her career? Not only did I nearly get her fired from her job at the clinic 2 years ago, but so much of the energy she should have been devoting to others has been wasted entirely on me. So whenever you say to me, let's get Lexi in for family therapy, or let's ask Lexi to write you an impact letter, it pisses me off. Because you seem to fail to understand that I already know how much I've hurt her. I'm not oblivious to it. I've seen it firsthand. It's not that I don't care about how much pain I've caused my sister. I do. I'd give anything to undo what I've done to her. She is everything to me. Sometimes I get high purely to escape the guilt of how much I've hurt her. And of course, I hurt her by using. So then I feel even worse, and I use again, and it just goes on and on.
Now do you see why I told you that you didn't need to explain guilt spirals? I've been in one for 7 fucking years. I've been constantly shocked by the depths I've tumbled to. Right from that morning after Lexi learned of my addiction, when the miserable look on her face was momentarily the most motivating factor on earth. But the impact of that moment would fade, just like every other come-to-Jesus moment I've skipped past over the years. Every time I decide to get clean, I seem to have the strength to decide it only once. And you and I both know that sobriety is deciding to be clean, again and again and again, making a momentous, exhausting decision every second for the rest of your life. As I'm writing this, I've been here in the clinic for well over a month. The shit should be well and truly gone from my system, but every cell in my body still craves a fix. I have to ask myself 12 times a minute if it's all worth it. Can I even stand to stay here in this clinic for 1 more minute? Do I even have the strength to face 1 more minute of asking myself if I want to stay? Because at the deepest levels of my soul, I don't want to stay here, Luke. I don't want to stay sober. I hate feeling like this. I hate how close I am to my pain. I hate how vivid the shame is. I need something between me and the rage, something to blur down its razor-sharp edges so I can stand to look at it. But now there's Daisy, and I want to see her. And I don't want the edges of her world to be blurred to me. I want to know her. I want to be enough for her. And I just don't know how I can do it. With or without the smack.
33. Lexi. When I get home, I lift Daisy's car seat out of the car, and I carry it carefully up the front steps to my front door. I rest the seat on the ground, unlock the door, and then I pause. I turn around and stare at my front yard and into the street. I suddenly wish I'd let Sam take the day off to be here to welcome her. It doesn't feel right that I'm here alone for this moment. This remarkable little girl, who at 6 weeks old has already been through something so difficult that most adults who attempt it fail. Well, she deserves a whole community to embrace her and to celebrate her. Daisy Vidler is a triumph. She is a living, breathing miracle. I look out across my street. Across the road, Mrs. Winters is tending her garden. And she sees me standing there, staring out, and offers me a vaguely disinterested wave. A delivery truck rumbles past. In the distance, a dog is barking. The world does not stop to celebrate this. The world doesn't even stop to contemplate it. I bend down and slip the car seat handle up onto my arm, and I see that she is awake. She has the pacifier in her mouth, but she is looking around, a gradually sharpening curiosity in her eyes. "Come on, sweetheart," I say gently. "Come and see your home. Your home for now, anyway." So I take Daisy into our house, and I gently lift her from the car seat to keep her close as I walk around showing her each room. "This will be your room. This one is mine and Sam's. Here is a kitchen. Here is the backyard." I feel like an idiot speaking to a baby, but I know that it needs to be done. How often have I told mothers and newborns that they should speak to their child to help their language development? I watched the nurses do this very thing all day at the hospital, and I have always felt too self-conscious to attempt it myself. But now she has only me. I could become overwhelmed again by the very thought of this, but I refuse to go there. And so I chat with Daisy. I chat as I set up her diapers and the new formula from the hospital pharmacy. And then, oddly, I keep chatting even after she is sleeping in her cot for the very first time. When Sam comes home, I greet him with surprising enthusiasm. My mood has lifted. Some strange optimism has arisen in me again now that Daisy is safe and well in our house. "Well," Sam looks at me in surprise when I pull back from our kiss.
So your first few hours alone with her are going well, then? I grin at him, then kiss him again. His skin is rough with stubble, and I rub my palm against his cheek. Take out and beers tonight, to celebrate Daisy's release? I murmur against his lips. Sam smiles at me, but says gently, Let's go easy on the beers. She is going to wake up for a feed every few hours. I grimace, and then giggle. What was that about you saying you were going to help me out with her? The landline rings, and I skip away from Sam to lift it to my ear. Hello? Lex? Of course it's Annie, and I squeal with excitement. Guess what? Guess who's here in my house?
She's out of the hospital?
Annie gasps. Oh, yes, she is, Annie. I grin, and Sam winks at me as he walks into the house. I breathe deeply and say into the phone, Don't worry, I've got photos of everything. I hear Annie sniffle, and my smile fades just a little. Are you okay?
Of course I'm okay, she says, and there's a weak laugh. Enough about me. Tell me more about Daisy. Where is she now?
She's sleeping in the cot in the room we set up for her. Don't worry, there's a baby monitor right next to her. It's an odd conversation, not because of what Annie and I talk about, but what we don't talk about. For 10 entire minutes, I fill her in on every single aspect of Daisy's care arrangements in my home, and it's only when we go to say goodbye that I ask again, Why did you call, love? Is everything okay?
It was a tough day, but hearing about Daisy has helped. I'm going to go now, okay? Take care of her for me.
Of course, I say. Always.
34. Annie. Luke, I know you're pissed off at me, again. And I know that you're disappointed in me, again. But I did try to warn you. I don't do singing or big groups of people, and I sure as hell don't do happy, clappy ceremonies. What about this is so difficult for you people to understand? I can't stand it, okay? I'm not being difficult. You are being difficult. I'm doing what you asked. I'm trying to work with you. But you have to meet me halfway. What possible good will come from forcing me into a stupid group ceremony? Will I come out of it more sober? Will it cure my addiction? Will it bring me closer to getting Daisy back? Unless the answer to these questions is yes, then I'm not going. Seriously, what are you going to do about it? Drag me there?
35. Lexi. The first time Daisy cries in the middle of the night, I think I'm dreaming. It escalates, but I ignore it for as long as I can until eventually I shake Sam awake and ask, Do you hear a baby crying? Lex, it's Daisy, he mumbles, and I fly out of bed so fast I stumble over my own feet as I cross the hall. The next morning I buy a bassinet so she can sleep in our room overnight. It's strange, gaining a baby so suddenly. There's an adjustment that needs to happen, and I spend that first weekend trying to figure out what it is, because Sam and I don't quite know what to do with ourselves. We divide up the backlog of half-done housework. He takes the laundry, I tackle the vacuuming and sweeping. But Daisy starts bellowing as soon as I start the vacuum, so I pick her up to soothe her. It then feels like only 5 minutes later that the whole day has disappeared, and Sam is talking about what to have for dinner. But what did we do today? I ask him blankly. How can it be dinner time? There were diapers and bottles. Sam looks at me, equally confused. I think this is what they call the newborn fog. I'm sure it'll pass, he says, and I laugh. Yeah, when she moves out.
Sam helps a lot over the weekend, but Monday looms, and I'll have a whole week alone with Daisy. I start to wonder when I should take Daisy to the rehab clinic. Annie hasn't seen her daughter for 6 weeks. As I'm thinking about this, it occurs to me that I haven't heard from Annie since I told her that Daisy was home with me. So I call Luke.
Rehabilitation is sometimes about ups and downs, he says, and I groan at the ominous declaration.
What happened?
First, the good news. She's really taken to that journal you sent up to us, so thanks for that.
Excellent. And?
Well, we started the journaling project with the goal that she'd let me read it, and we're not quite there yet. Even so, it's helping her to open up. She's spoken to me about a few things already that were off limits during our earlier chats.
There's a but after all of this positive stuff, and the longer you prolong telling me what it is, the worse I'm expecting it to be.
I've given your sister a lot of leeway since she arrived. We don't often get patients who are in the immediate postpartum period, and then, of course, Annie chose to detox so quickly, and that was very hard on her. So she's been keeping to herself a lot, and I've let her as she's settled in. But she's a third of the way through her treatment now, and she's still not engaging with the other patients and staff. I can't let that persist. The community-building stuff we do is really very important for recovery. She told me she was going to come to this morning's group therapy session, then she didn't show up. So I had a discussion with her about it, and she had some issues controlling her emotions around that.
She lost her temper, right? I sigh and I shake my head. She always does this.
It was fairly ugly.
So what happens now?
I had to issue her a caution. I'm hoping that will encourage her to comply with the basic community rules here.
And if it doesn't?
I'll give her a day to think about it. If she's not at the community meeting on Wednesday, I'll issue her another caution.
How many cautions can she get?
3. Then we ask her to leave.
I've been calm up until now, but as Luke says those words, my heart starts to race.
Oh, shit. This isn't a disaster, it's just a minor stumbling block.
So, I was actually calling to see if I could visit, maybe with Daisy? I whisper, and I think he's going to laugh at the very idea. But Luke surprises me.
You know what, Alexis? I think we might just dangle that carrot in front of her nose and see if it encourages her to move in the right direction. I've got a session with her this afternoon. I'll let you know how it goes.
36. Annie. Luke. When I realized I was pregnant, I thought I'd found the answer. You've probably heard other patients talk about the same idea. Every addict knows about the answer. It's the silver bullet that you think you need to fix your life, usually something that will cure the addiction, or even better, some way to solve your problems but allow you to keep right on using, which is what you really want to do. I've sometimes thought the right rehab would be the answer, or the right boyfriend, or for Lexi to be more supportive in some magical way, or for Dad to come back somehow, or for Mom to stop being so disinterested. When I found out about Daisy, I was both terrified and delighted, because if anything was going to fix me, surely it would be a baby. All that I knew of getting high and being pregnant was that the two things did not go together, and so I decided I'd detox at home. I tried and failed a few times, and that made me despise myself even more. I'd be cursing aloud as I put the needle into my arm, then sobbing with guilt until the drug kicked in, and I no longer cared. Later, I'd promise her that was the very last time. I hadn't spoken to Mom much over the years since she reconnected with Lexi, only on occasions where Lexi had called her and Mom was on the line when I took the phone, so I knew I wouldn't have to speak to Robert. But when I realized I was pregnant, I needed Mom. It's crazy because since Dad died, she's hardly been Mother of the Year material. but I thought somehow she could offer me some wisdom that would help me to be a good mom. I'd brace myself. I'd shoot up in the morning, and while I was still high enough to feel at peace, I'd dial her number on my cell. That way, even if Robert answered, the sound of his voice wouldn't send me into a tailspin that persisted for days. To help survive those calls with Mom, I imagined that I was living a different life. I was living in a beautiful apartment in Montgomery and working at a small, independent literary magazine. My boss's name was Hector, and his secretary was Irma, and I was mostly reviewing and editing submissions. The money wasn't great, but I was getting by and doing well. I had a wide circle of friends, but no boyfriend. I was concentrating on my writing on the side. In reality, I was living in the baby's father's trailer, which was empty because he was in jail. Dale told me that he'd prepaid the rent for 12 months because he kept blowing his money, and at least this way he knew he had somewhere to live for a year. And once he got locked up, it seemed a shame to let a comfortable, warm space like that go to waste. I'd been in a few god-awful crack dens since I left Lexi, and for a while I stayed with another dealer I knew. But then he started expecting sex every time he hooked me up with a fix. And that got old pretty quick. So Dale's shitty trailer was a marked improvement, but it was still a far cry from the beautiful home I lived in when I spoke with Mom. Mom was also telling me lies of her own every time we talked, because whenever I chatted with her, she was about to do something she was excited about. But I knew that in reality, Mom's role was to keep Robert happy and cared for. She wasn't there to live a full life. She was there to facilitate one for Robert. And so, during those semi-frequent conversations between Mom and me, we simply swapped lies. But at least we were connecting. I was hopeful that one day one of us would say something vulnerable or true, and when we did, all of the walls would come down around us. But in those few months between my initiating those calls and my realizing I was just desperate enough to call Lexi, neither Mom nor I ever had the courage to be ourselves. And so, at the end of the day, all of the effort I'd put into trying to rebuild that bridge was wasted. I still wound up alone, and I'm still a failure as a mom. I know exactly what I was looking for by trying to connect with her again. It was her method of parenting. She'd been an amazing mother before Dad died, the perfect role model for who I know I need to be. One day, I'm going to get Daisy a beautiful big house like we used to have. I'm going to have a job, a career. Maybe I'll get back on my feet and start writing again. Maybe I'll even marry someone who can be a proper father to her. We'll have enough money for her to have opportunities and go to a good school and get a decent education. Daisy deserves it. She deserves so much better than what I've given her so far. I have to promise myself and her that by the time she is old enough to understand any of this, I'll have my life sorted out. I already know what you would say if I let you read this, Luke. You'd tell me that Dream for Daisy is just a series of small, manageable steps. Steps I don't need my mother for, particularly given where she's ended up. You'd tell me that the first step is simply to get myself to that community meeting tomorrow. I don't know if that's true, but I'm out of other options, since you issued me that fucking caution last time. So I'm going to put that photo of Daisy in my pocket, and I'm going to try to make myself go in the morning.
37. Lexi. Luke asked me to come in for a family therapy session with Annie. I packed my SUV, loading it with diapers and wipes and bottles and formula and pacifiers and every other thing I can think of. Then Daisy and I set off on the journey toward her mother. She's unsettled on the way, and I stop four times before we even reach the highway. I give her a pacifier. I adjust her seatbelt in case it's uncomfortable. I even dangle a brightly colored toy from the straps above her, thinking it might distract her. Nothing works. And a squawking infant in the back seat is much more unsettling than I had anticipated, so I quickly become frustrated. "Come on, Daisy, now," I groan when she starts grizzling for a fifth time. "I thought babies were supposed to sleep in cars. Don't you want to see your mama?" The sound of my voice, frustrated though the tone may be, seems to console her a little, and a thought strikes me. I start to sing, and she falls silent. "Twinkle, twinkle, little star,
Do you know how loved you are? In the morning, in the night, I love you with all my might. Twinkle, twinkle, little star.
It's amazing how that song takes me all the way back to when Annie came home from the hospital as a baby. It's one of my very first memories, standing in the doorway to her bedroom, watching as Mom fed her and then sung that song as she laid her onto the cot. I remember the soft lamplight and the look of sheer adoration on Mom's face, and how jealous I felt of Annie. I also know that I used to sing that very song to Annie once we moved to the community, and so I try to take myself back to those memories. On a scientific level, I find it fascinating that it is so much harder for me to recollect details from that period than it is to remember my happier early childhood memories. My voice trails off, and Daisy stirs and then bellows. So I start again, and then again, and again, until I've sung the same damned maddening verse the entire hour it takes me to get to the rehab clinic. Even once she's fallen silent, I don't want to stop in case she cries again, so I just keep singing. When we pull into the parking lot at the rehab clinic, I finally stop the song. Daisy doesn't stir, and I breathe a sigh of relief. I clip her car seat into the stroller and push it carefully into the rehab center. Last time I came, I ran to Annie. This time she runs toward me, but she ignores me altogether. Instead, she crowds over the car seat and reaches to touch her sleeping daughter's face with visibly trembling hands. Annie doesn't say a word. She doesn't even cry. She simply stares as if she's completely awed by her daughter. I let her stand there until the minutes start to stretch, and then I touch her back gently and ask, "Are we meeting Luke somewhere?" Annie shakes herself as if I've startled her, but then she takes the handles of the stroller from me. I'm delighted to see her take the initiative, but I'm somehow offended at the same time. Suddenly I start to worry that perhaps I'm getting a bit too caught up in this whole playing Daisy's mother game. And does that mean I'm getting too attached? I follow Annie to a table where she sets the stroller close to her and rocks it gently as she raises her gaze to mine. I smile at her, but she simply stares at me. I can't read her either. Is she upset? Annie? I prompt gently, and she looks back to the baby. Luke said he wanted to speak to us together. Are we supposed to meet him somewhere? Not yet, Annie says. She leans down and rests her head against the stroller's sun visor, staring at the baby. Let's just take a few minutes alone. You need to bring her here more often. I need to be reminded why I have to make this work.
Annie, I thought we agreed you'd meet with Lexi and Daisy in my office.
Luke approaches us, and I rise and shake his hand. Hello, Luke.
Welcome back, Alexis. There's been some confusion. Annie, weren't you coming straight in to see me?
I just want to see my baby for a minute without supervision, Annie says flatly. She tries to stare him down, and I feel a shiver of fear run through me. I know that look on her face, the narrowing of her eyes and the pinch of her lips as she presses them together. That look has never preceded anything good.
Maybe we can come into you in a few minutes, I suggest to Luke hesitantly. But he ignores me. His gaze is on Annie.
I agreed to this visit on the condition that we conduct a family therapy session at the same time. Annie, you simply cannot change our agreement now. I'll give you some time alone with Lexi and the baby at the end, after we talk. Okay?
Annie's hands are balled in fists. I can see the part of her that just wants to be with her baby, battling against the part that wants to counter Luke's authority. She stares at the baby, motionless, and I don't know what to do. I want to help her. I need to help her.
Just as I open my mouth to suggest again that Luke give us a few minutes, Annie rises sharply and walks off, pushing the stroller in front of her. I stand too, but Luke gently touches my upper arm. Let me handle this. She needs you to let me handle this. Got it? It's my turn to stare down an internal battle. I keep glancing at Annie and the rapidly disappearing stroller, then at Luke, who is determined, staring at me with the question lingering in his eyes. Okay, I say eventually, and then I walk quickly after my sister into his office. I like to start these sessions by touching base with our feelings, Luke says. I'll go first. Today I'm feeling frustrated because I had an agreement with you, Annie. I thought I'd been generous in allowing this visit in order to win your trust. But the first thing you did was to go against the terms we discussed. Your turn. I'm feeling pissed off because I'm an adult woman and a mother, and I shouldn't have to give in to your blackmail in order to see my daughter. Annie says flatly. They both look at me. I stare between them blankly. I don't know. There's no right answer, Luke says patiently, and I adjust my skirt and glance around the room while I try to think of something to say. Just say what you're feeling so we can get this over and done with, Annie says sharply. She's looking at the floor, but I can see from the way she's holding herself that she's a tinderbox of anger just waiting to explode. Her arms are crossed over her chest, her eyebrows are knitted, and her lips are still in that tight, furious line. I'm feeling scared, I whisper. Annie's eyebrows momentarily dip as she ponders this, and then she looks at me. Go on, Luke prompts, and I clear my throat and admit. I can see that Annie is on edge. I know how much she has to lose. I'm scared. Are you scared for Annie or for yourself? Luke asks. Or for Daisy, Annie says, and I look at the sleeping baby, then back to her mother. For you. Only for you. I can handle myself, Annie whispers to me, and Luke leans forward in his chair and rests his elbows on his knees as he prompts me. How does that make you feel, Lexi, when Annie says she can handle herself? It's not a how I feel, it's a what I feel. I want to argue with her and point out to her how wrong she is. If she could handle herself, we wouldn't be in this situation. Put some emotions to it, Lexi. We want to talk about the feelings now, not the action they inspire. Can I take this one? Annie interrupts, and I look at her in surprise. Luke nods silently, and Annie stares at me as she says, You're feeling frustrated, because you think that I need you to baby me, and I don't want to let you right now. I'm frustrated, I concede, but not because you won't let me baby you. I'm frustrated because we might end up in a situation where I'll have to baby you. How would you feel, Lexi? If you had a newborn and you had to agree to humiliating therapy sessions just to get 5 minutes alone with her. If I was in your situation, I'd be embarrassed and angry, I agree. But I'd be angry at myself, not the people who were trying to help me. He isn't trying to help me right now, Annie hisses, and her face reddens. He's trying to control me. Don't you see that? He's trying to get you to a place where you can give yourself over to the process and get clean. We don't use the word clean in here, Lexi, Luke interrupts me. We use the word sober. When I frown at him, he explains gently, What's the opposite of clean? Dirty, Annie snaps, and she stands. Which is what I am, a dirty, filthy junkie. Fuck this and fuck both of you. She's raised her voice and Daisy stirs. I watch as Annie's expression shifts from fury to horror in an instant. I see the guilt as it rises in her eyes, and then she glances helplessly toward me.
I rise too and extend a hand toward her hesitantly.
You aren't dirty, I say desperately.
Please don't say that, Annie. I shouldn't have said clean. It's just a throwaway word. I won't use it anymore.
Please sit down and let's do this, please.
Then I'll stay and you can have some time with Daisy. She's going to need a bottle soon and a diaper change, and then she loves to cuddle and play, so please, Annie.
Please.
I know it's hard, but I promise it will be worth it.
By the time I finish speaking, my voice is breaking and there are tears in my eyes. Annie looks back to the baby. Then she slowly, carefully, lowers herself back into her seat and looks to Luke.
Go on then, she prompts him pointedly. Shrink me.
In the next hour, I see firsthand what Luke is up against. He asks a question, Annie deflects it. He tries again, she responds with sarcasm. He tries again, she shuts down. It's not just the big, deep questions that she responds to this way. It's even the simple ones, like how she's feeling about her progress at the center, or what her plans are for the next week, or how she felt at the whole community meeting that she dragged herself to this morning. I'm not sure what he hoped to achieve by having me here. I'm only making things worse, because as I watch Annie block all of Luke's attempts to get her to open up, I interject again and again, imploring her to drop the attitude, or to just try. And every time I do, Luke patiently asks me to save my comments for engaging in the session myself, rather than trying to facilitate it. Right on cue, when the hour is up, Daisy starts to cry. Luke asks for a few minutes alone with Annie, so I take the baby to a small kitchenette and prepare her formula. Then I take the bottle back to Luke's office so that Annie can feed her daughter.
If you're comfortable with this, Lexi, perhaps Annie could take Daisy into the dining hall to feed her, so you and I can chat alone?
Luke asks. Annie immediately stiffens.
Why wouldn't she be comfortable with it? She snaps, and Luke shrugs.
Lexi is Daisy's legal guardian at the moment.
I'm her mother. Of course I'm comfortable, I say hastily, and I push the stroller toward Annie and point to the bottle. She will probably only drink half of that, and then if you sit her up for a while so she can burp, fine.
Annie pushes Daisy from the room, and Luke quietly closes the door behind her.
That was actually a very productive session, he says as he returns to his desk.
I stare at him in disbelief. You've got to be kidding me.
Let me tell you what some of our other therapy sessions have looked like. Annie sits and stares out the window. Annie writes in her journal, but refuses to look at me. Annie throws insults at me and tries to hook me personally. Annie just doesn't show up. Annie shows up, but turns her chair to face the other way.
My heart sinks. So we are doomed, then, I whisper, and he shakes his head.
None of this is atypical with court-mandated patients. Sobriety isn't actually something a court can force onto a person.
What's the plan from here?
I didn't ask you to stay back to talk about the plan. I wanted to ask you how you felt about what just happened, and to check in with how you're coping.
I found that session to be frustrating and bewildering, but I'm coping just fine.
You and your sister have a very special bond, don't you?
We do.
What's the best outcome from all of this for you, Alexis?
Annie graduates your program and is well again.
Be more specific. What does that look like?
I hesitate. She can resume life the way it was before the addiction. She can write, get a job, have a healthy relationship, get a house, care for Daisy.
What about your relationship with her, Lexi? What would that look like?
We'd be friends again, I whisper. Then out of nowhere, I'm crying and I can't stop myself.
How long has it been since you and Annie were friends? your relationship seems almost parental to me.
Well, yes, it has been, but not always. When she lived with me, I got glimpses of friendship all the time. My best memories of her were when she'd write some brilliant little vignette and she'd let me read it, and then we could talk about it like two scholars. I'd comment on how great the premise was, she'd tell me about something she was trying to achieve, or she'd write a poem, and there'd be this incredible depth to it, and she'd explain it to me, and I'd be in awe of her mind and the way she could just see something magnificent in the ordinariness of life. Or we'd go out for coffee on a Saturday morning, and we'd talk about politics or the weather, or some cute guy sitting near us, or what boots we wanted to buy for the winter. She probably doesn't even remember those moments, but I choke on a sob and admit, I'm living for them. I grieve them. I miss the Annie that I shared those things with. She's still in there, behind the wall the substance abuse has put between us, and I'd give anything to get her back.
Sometimes to draw something out of a person, we have to approach them differently. Do you know how you were approaching Annie in those moments of friendship, Lexi?
I don't know what you mean.
Our parents see a very different side of us than our friends do. Luke shrugs. I know you've needed to parent Annie, and after watching you two interact today and speaking to you over the last few weeks, I think it's become a habit to you. Do you know what I'd like to suggest? Try being her friend.
I stare at Luke, and I try to figure out how I could implement his advice.
What is the difference between my parenting Annie and being her friend?
Then it hits me. The difference is responsibility. A friend can offer support, even advice, but a friendship is a two-way street, and friends hold none of the responsibility for each other's actions. Being Annie's friend means letting go of my ownership of her outcomes.
I'll try, I whisper, and Luke gives me a satisfied nod.
I find Annie in the dining hall, sitting in a corner. She's angled the stroller in front of herself so that it creates a barrier from the rest of the room. She has Daisy resting on the table, but she's supporting her head and shoulders with her palms. Annie is talking to her daughter quietly. She's smiling, but her face is wet with tears. I don't want to intrude, so I hang back, standing in the doorway of the office wing. After a while, Annie notices me and motions for me to join them.
See what I'm up against with him?
She says as soon as I sit down, and the bubble of joy I floated on as I watched her with her baby deflates in an instant.
Have you written any poetry since you came here?
I ask Annie, and her stare is incredulous. I've been kind of busy.
I miss your poetry. I miss those stories you used to write.
She looks back to Daisy. Maybe I could write something for her, she says after a while.
Did you love writing, Annie?
You know I did.
Why did you stop?
It seemed pointless. No one wants to hear what someone like me has to say.
I do.
Annie swallows. I'm writing this journal for Luke. It has everything in it. All about me. She glances at me. Maybe you could read it someday.
Are you going to let Luke read it too?
I don't know. I'm scared to.
What are you afraid of?
I'm afraid that loads of things. I'm afraid that he'll pity me. I'm afraid that he'll use it to control me. At the moment, all of the things in that journal are mine. They are my secrets, my perspective on the world. I have nothing left but that.
Daisy burps suddenly, the sound surprisingly loud for such a tiny person.
Annie and I laugh together, our gazes locking, our faces fixed in smiles. The moment is perfect, and I'm still smiling when I say, I need to buy some new boots. When you're out of here, do you want to come shopping with me? I have no idea what kind to get.
We could go get lunch or a coffee after and talk like we used to.
Annie looks at me as if I've lost my mind. Then she starts to laugh again.
Sure, Lexi. In 2 months' time, at the start of spring, when I finally get out of this shithole, we'll go buy you some nice warm boots that you won't wear until next winter.